Just a tidbit of news from the Department of Defense and the Pentagon and from Capitol Hill. The President, on July 6, 2015, briefed the Pentagon on the progress of our troop training in the Middle East. Give a listen and see if you hear something here.
As I've said before, this aspect of our strategy was moving too slowly, but the fall of Ramadi has galvanized the Iraqi government. So with the additional steps I ordered last month, we're speeding up training of ISIL forces, including volunteers from Sunni tribes in Anbar province. More Sunni volunteers are coming forward.
Hey folks, you're listening to Veterans Truth Radio Network. Turn off that fake crap and turn on the real news. Latest in news on the Veterans Radio Network.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Stu Webb, and this is VeteransTruthNetwork.com, and it is July the 14th, 2015. And I have a special guest on. There are actually two special guests. One, I've got Harley Schlanger coming on in just a moment. And he's one of the top journalists in this country. He wrote a book called Don't Beep, the book that sent Henry Kissinger crazy. And he's a famous investigator. We're going to be having a chat with him about the latest around the world. Dr. Rima Lebole is going to join us the last half an hour as a host here because she made a significant history with Farrakhan's son on her live TV program on Monday. And we're going to be talking about it, uniting the Christians, the Jews, and the Muslims against the New World Order. But before we do that, today's a day that's kind of special to me. My daughter, she's 31 years of age, and most of you know my situation. Well, I called her today, folks, and we'll see if she returns a call. But I've got a little thing for her right here, real quick, that I'm going to play, and then we're going to get on with my guest, Harley Schlanger.
Happy birthday to you.
With that said, folks, I'm going to get straight to my guest here, Harley Schlanger. How are you this evening, sir?
Stu, I'm doing pretty well, all things considering.
Harley Schlanger, are we on the air?
Yes, can you hear me?
Harley?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm not getting any mic with Harley here. Harley, for some reason, I'm not coming through. You have your phone muted?
No, my phone's fine.
I'm seeing you move. Hang on, folks. Gene, let's go to a song real quick until we get my guest on here. We are having a problem. If you would, please.
Hello?
We got a technical difficulty here. Harley, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hang on. Stand by. We'll pick this up in a minute. Okay, Harley, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me now?
We're having tough problems here, folks, for a moment. I'm seeing him coming on, but we're not getting voice for some reason.
Are you hearing me now?
What's happening here?
Hello, Stu?
Well, I'm not hearing him, and other people are hearing him. Hold on a second. Okay, Harley, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm sorry. It's on my technical end on my side. I apologize to you, and I'm good, and I'm glad to have you on. Now,
all right. Good to be with you.
Yeah, well, Harley, you and I kind of had a meeting one time back in 1993 after I got out of federal prison down there in Houston, and we had a hell of a discussion. And, of course, I didn't know that you wrote the book Dope Inc., the book that sent Henry Kissinger crazy. And I learned a lot from you. And you've done a lot of work with the Federalist newspaper and Executive Intelligence Review, I believe it's called. And you're still at it.
Actually, on that book, I was one of the researchers. It was actually a team led by my associate, who you also know, Jeffrey Steinberg. But it did drive Kissinger crazy. It also drove the Queen of England a little bit crazy, because we identified the networks internationally that were involved in drug money laundering and drug trafficking. And everything we said in that book has turned out to be vindicated, including our identification as the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank as the leading drug money laundering bank in the world. Up till today, just last 6 months ago, it was just hit again by the Justice Department. They were fined $1.5 billion for laundering tens of billions of dollars in drug money, but no one went to jail. They were never shut down. So I'm still at it because the bad guys are still at it, and someone's got to fight for the country.
Well, we haven't talked about that part of it, but HSCB Bank was owned by my ex-in-law, Leonard Millman, that owned Great West Life. And if you look at Great West Life, they are the owners of, out of Denver, Colorado, HSCB Bank, which I don't know whether you're aware of it, but Scott Bennett, who's a host on here, a lieutenant, Army Intelligence, he'll be a host on Friday, and I can hook you up with him. He's got the money trail on all the ISIS funding. And tremendous amounts of it going through HSCB Bank, as well as several banks in Switzerland. And they lock him 2 years to silence.
HSBC, the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, as it used to be known, has been fined also, as you've just pointed out, for laundering money for purchase of weapons for terrorists. It's the go-to bank since the 1860s when it was founded. For dirty operations. It was originally founded at the time of the Second Opium War, when the British were imposing opium on the Chinese. And when the Chinese resisted for the second time, the British sent their leading ships and admirals in, destroyed Shanghai, took over Hong Kong, and they set up a bank. And they used that bank from then to the present as a center for money laundering. And, of course, HSBC since then is fully integrated into the City of London banks, the too-big-to-fail banks in New York City, and also banks in places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, which were banks of choice for the bin Laden family on behalf of the Saudis to launder money for Al-Qaeda and Taliban. So it's all one dirty network, which, despite a lot of material that's been done, and a lot of good people have investigated this and confirmed this, and yet there's still this bank still functions. And it just shows that the when people complain about government not doing anything, government right now in the United States is run by these corporations, by these bankers. And that's why they're not doing anything to stop it.
You know, HSCB Bank on its board of directors is Norman Brownstein, Daddy Bush's CI counsel when he was CI director back in the mid-70s. And he was also, of course, on the board of directors of Silverado, where Neil Bush was laundering the drug money. And he's an APEC director. He was Leonard Millman's attorney, my ex-in-law, and he was the attorney for Larry Mizell, the bank bailout scamster. And HSBC and this bank was selling the derivatives worldwide after Mizell had traded them through MDC, the artificial mortgages. So,
and this was also integrated with the BCCI bank, which was eventually shut down, but which in the 70s and the 80s was the nexus point for much of the smuggling and drug money laundering. And, you know, so, look, these things could have been shut down. You knew the story or a piece of the story years ago. Our book, The Dope Incorporated, was a roadmap for a prosecutor. And I've talked to some prosecutors who read it who were astounded by the material in it. And they said, why didn't anybody do anything? And I said, why are they still not doing anything? So what we're doing with the EIR, with the LaRouche Network, we're still fighting to get some patriots to stand up and stop this whining about how powerful the bankers are. They're not powerful. They're sitting on top of the biggest bankrupt institutions in the world. They've got trillions of dollars of worthless paper that they're backing up with the 0% loans from the Federal Reserve. If we put them through a bankruptcy reorganization using the tool that was used in the last depression in the 33-34 period by Franklin Roosevelt, the Glass-Steagall bill, these banks would be put under and you'd take the criminal bankers and put them in prison. But as you point out, during the SNL scandal, they put a lot of people in prison, but most of those were local bankers. The people running it at the top were tied to the Bush family and they got off scot-free, including Neil Bush from Silverado.
Yeah, the only one that really went to jail that had any fame was the Charles Keating, and that was because of that BCCI lawsuit the LaRock law firm had. And well, D.C. settled on that, Silverado settled on that, I think for $800,000 when they claimed they were in bankruptcy and they were holding the $12 trillion of Keating's stolen loot. And of course,
well, BCCI, and Keating, remember, Keating was protected by John McCain.
Yes, he was.
And McCain not only protected him, but McCain was promoting him. When Keating was selling these worthless CDs, these non-FDIC-backed CDs for $200,000 a pop to senior citizens in Arizona, John McCain was at Keating's side saying, this is a good man, it's a good deal. And of course, there was nothing backing it. And when the House of Cards collapsed, Keating did go to prison. I'll tell you one thing interesting. Yep. Stu, one thing interesting about that, John McCain just signed on as a co-sponsor of the new Glass-Steagall bill with Elizabeth Warren. And while I think John McCain is practically insane or senile, he's a lunatic, he wants to go to war everywhere he can, this is the one good thing he does, and I think it's because he's still guilty about the tens of thousands of senior citizens in Arizona that were cheated out of their life savings by Keating with his collaboration.
But Keating, because I had the Rock law firm, Don West, I don't even remember him or not, but he was the PI, a former writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he came to Kansas City to see me because I had tons of paperwork on him. And, you know, that whole BCCI thing, originally when it popped in Arkansas down there on Jackson Stevens, tied to Little Rock. Of course, it was Hillary Clinton who at the Rose Law Firm that was the one that represented him in the lawsuit with the Securities Exchange Commission. I have that paperwork, folks, up on the front of StuWeb.com in the middle column. Click on the one, Kerry Millman Witch Doctor, and you can see it there. And it's inside that document that shows Hillary. But, you know, they were all in bed together. This whole thing, BCCI, if anybody had ever really been prosecuted on it, we wouldn't be having the problems today that we're having.
Well, it would have gone directly at the Bush family, which when you talk about the center of organized crime in this country, it's the Bush family going back to Granddaddy Prescott Bush, And this is another book that I was working on with my associates called George H.W. Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, which goes through how, in fact, one of my associates, who is a co-author, Anton Chaitkin, found the actual document in the archives of the order announcing the seizure of Prescott Bush's bank, the Union Bank Corporation of New York. Prescott Bush was one of two board members, American board members. The other one was Averell Harriman's younger brother, Roland Harriman, who was a skull and bonesman with Prescott Bush at Yale. This was a bank that in September 1942, was seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act, because that bank was continuing to fund the Nazis after we declared war on them in December 1941. So for another 9 months, this Wall Street law firm, which included as a senior partner Prescott Bush, was funding the Nazis. It actually started funding the Nazis in the middle 1930s. And so here you have the Bush family in cahoots with the Harrimans and Schroeder Bank and Montague Norman, the head of Bank of England, funding the Nazis. And then his son, George H.W. Bush, starts out as a fairly young man with Zapata Petroleum, CIA connections there. Very shady story, the history of George H.W. Bush. But essentially, after the assassination attempt against Ronald Reagan, Bush Sr. was running many of the dirty operations from the White House, including the destruction of the savings and loans, including the cocaine for arms deal called the Iran-Contra scandal, in which he was sending weapons to the Ayatollahs and then using some of the money to buy cocaine in South America, which was then being shipped into Los Angeles to launch the crack epidemic to fund their operations. And then, of course, his son, George W. Bush, the best thing you can say about him is that maybe he didn't really know what he was doing, but certainly Dick Cheney did. And now they're going with the so-called smarter Bush brother, Jeb Bush. So, you know, what are we looking at? We're looking at a third generation of a real Nazi family, organized crime family, gangster family, and very few people have the guts to say that. And then, of course, you know, Neil Bush was sort of a minor figure in this, but you couldn't turn your head away from him without fear that he'd pick your pocket.
You know, that's very true. And, you know, when I was locked up as a political prisoner, and I met you the following few months later when I got out, you know, I had learned that there was over $12 trillion laundered through Silverado in a 9-year period of time. And they were paying drug pilots with stock issued by Meyer Blinder, the world's largest penny stock corp. They were fake stocks, so they could get the loans that were non-recourse over there against the stock with Neil. And that's how they were paying drug pilots. And I mean, I learned so much being down there in Springfield with 1,500 Iran-Contra players. And of course, Harley, we haven't talked too much off the air because I know where you come from and stuff. And I don't need to ask you too many questions off the air. But my partner on this network is Gene Chip Tatum. I don't know if you remember him or not, but he was commissioned. He was a CIA assassin, part of the Pegasus group. And he worked for Ollie North and George Herbert Walker Bush. And when his team was told to neutralize Ross Perot during the 1992 election, he says, no, he isn't going to do it. And they charged him with treason and sedition was one of the charges. Well, Gene recently got off all his probation over all this and out of the problem. But, you know, he delivered cocaine to Bill Clinton at the airport in Arkansas at the Air Force Base. And Jackson Stevens and Roger Clinton were right there, and he's got the flight plans and everything. And Gene, if you remember, Gary Webb at San Jose Mercury Press that was breaking about the crack epidemic, well, it was Gene Chip Tatum, it was Terry Reid and Michael Rupert were the three that were doing it. And I was cranking up Maxine Waters, the congresswoman, and she was all getting all bent out of shape. And Gene started talking to her, and then she was going to hold hearings. And then suddenly she pulled the plug on us. And
well, you remember, because I know this is, I think this is where we first met, when the story came out from Gary Webb. Maybe we met a little before that.
But
the Gary Webb.
Yeah, 93. It was 95 to 97. Gary Webb was doing
That's right, 95. I was going to Los Angeles as Mr. LaRouche's Western State spokesman starting in 94. And you'd mentioned Farrakhan earlier. We had a press conference in Watts, and the Farrakhan people were there because they wanted to know where was this stuff coming from. We had a very large group of ministers in Los Angeles who were delighted to see the San Jose Mercury News story because it explained a lot. That, you know, how does a street operative like Freeway Ricky Ross, how does he suddenly get his hands on millions of dollars of cocaine coming into the country? And this is what Gary Webb told the story. And in the process of doing this, Maxine Waters, as you said, had some town meetings, and I attended a couple of these town meetings. And the problem with Maxine is that she wished to be very general in saying, it's the CIA, it's the CIA, it's the CIA. And my associates and I would jump up and say, no, it was George Herbert Walker Bush. Let's name the real names. And we had a chance to meet with Maxine afterwards, and she said, look, I know it was Bush, but you know, people here think it's the CIA, and that's good enough for me. But the point is, there was a possibility around that to get to the heart of this network. It was the second opportunity. The first time when we published Dope Incorporated, let me just go back a step to make this point. In 1980-81, the Hongshang Bank, the HSBC Bank, tried to take over Marine Midland so that it could get a base in the United States. And we organized the bank superintendent of New York, whose name was Muriel Siebert, who was a fairly courageous woman, to deny the right of HSBC to take over Marine Midland, which was a New York State corporation. So what happened then is Marine Midland went to the Federal Reserve, got a national charter, and then HSBC could take them over. So there was a possibility to fight this network then, which was lost. Then again with Maxine Waters. And the problem that second time is that all the media of the country, especially the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, ran incredible slanders against Gary Webb and literally destroyed him, ruined his career, but left him penniless, demoralized, and then most likely he was assassinated, given that his so-called suicide occurred with two bullets to the head, which is rather hard to do. So this was another effort to take out the people who were telling the truth. And you also know, I'm sure, that Mr. LaRouche himself was put in jail by George Bush. In fact, he went to jail just shortly before Bush was inaugurated, and he was given a 15-year term under the with the charge, conspiracy, one-man conspiracy to defraud the Internal Revenue Service. So, you know, these are just examples of the fight that's gone on to go after these guys.
Yeah. Now, I remember that, you know, Maxine Waters, she caved on us because I was talking to her, Jean Chip Tatum was, and we're going to get hearings and all that. And it was kind of ironic. We thought she got paid off and somewhere along the line. And here I had Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman of Georgia.
Right.
She had met with me in here in Kansas City over 911, came and saw me on what I had on them. Those military exercises going on, the FBI and all that stuff. And so anyway, I had her on about a couple months ago. And before I put her on, we were talking about this very incident with Maxine Waters. And she says, Stu, she says, that's not true. She didn't back down. She says, what happened is her driver was shot in the head. I said, what? Oh, yeah. That's what made her run and hide. Stop. She was afraid.
Yeah, it was fear. And I can tell you more because another decade later, when she was leading the fight against the mortgage-backed securities and the derivative operations, because she's a sharp cookie. She's, you know, some people think she's a little bit wild. I think basically she's a person who wants to fight, but they indicted her grandson, who was her chief of staff, and accused him of being involved in getting illegal bailout money, TARP money, for her husband's bank. Now, her husband's bank got something like $10 million. J.P. Morgan Chase got $10 billion. You know, the fact that Maxine's husband's bank got some money had nothing to do with Maxine, because there were a number of smaller banks that got money, but they used it to destroy her grandson. So she knows what it means to be targeted. And I really wish that she would have been a little more forceful when Barney Frank, the crook from Massachusetts, was working with Wall Street boy Chris Dodd to write the Dodd-Frank bill, which was a bill that legalized thievery on the derivative market, supposedly to re-regulate banking, and all it did was create bigger loopholes for the banks to use.
Yeah, I know.
And Maxine knew it. I spoke with her about it, and she knew it, but I think she really got the message back in 94, 95, 96, and then again in 2008, 2009, that there's a limit to what they were going to let her do.
I think you may be right about that. So, by the way, former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney is going to be a host on our show. She's running for Congress again, but she'll be here. It'd be Dr. Cynthia McKinney by the time she gets on the air in September. So we're going to have fun with that. But, you know, Carla, you've been all over the board. I mean, you know, this derivative thing and the mortgages, I know because I turned in my SEC whistleblower complaint. I filed in federal court here in Kansas City, and then they tried to murder me for doing it. Injunctive relief and filing on those mortgages, and they rolled me three times on a concrete barrier. I thought it was three times, but I guess it was only one time, according to the recreator, an FBI agent, because they covered it up. You know, it smashed me up pretty heavy rolling on a concrete barrier in a van. I broke my neck and so forth, but you know, I had turned in that they wrote $100 trillion with the artificial mortgages through MBC Holdings, the parent company of Silverado, Richmond American Homes and all that, and they were bundling them up, and then Norman Brownstein, that was Mizell, and then Brownstein, the attorney, Milman Mizell and Daddy Bush's attorney, was derivatizing them through that HSCB bank and passing them, and that's how they did this. And, you know,
they don't leave out such august institutions as Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, the former Wachovia Bank, which you may remember.
AIG.
These were all banks. Yeah, AIG was a big source. And then the investment banks. At the time, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch were not commercial banks. They were investment banks. So how did they get so much money to be able to move in and create out of the derivatives a leverage on top of it? Because when you talk about 10 trillion, 100 trillion, that sort of makes people's eyes bug out. But at times there's been more than $250 billion in derivatives that are involved in trading. And these got their start with the mortgages that were bundled and securitized and turned into mortgage-backed securities.
Now, and what they did those was with insurance policies, mainly off of Metropolitan Life. And those were loans in the event of someone died, supposedly. They were creating these artificial loan or artificial insurance policies on there, too, that I found out about.
Well, it started with fraudulent mortgages where they were putting people who no way could they afford a $300,000 or $400,000 home. And yet they were writing these mortgages, which included interest only or what were they called? Floating exchange loans and so on.
That was part of Harley. The part I found out about, because I got it from some sources in Colorado, that what they were doing is MDC, you know, through asset investors, and you can see on the front of my site the SEC whistleblower filing on it, but they were bundling them up through asset investors, a subsidiary company of MDC, and they were buying up mortgages from around the country, $2 billion worth here, and then they would turn around and they would take and duplicate the mortgages in bundles. So they were selling.
Well, and let me just say something for your listeners who may not know exactly what we're talking about, because I found this is a very important point that has to be made. When you talk about a derivative, what the term actually describes the transaction. It's a piece of paper that is derived from something of value but has no value in itself. It's sort of like a futures market in which there's no product at the end term. You know, when you had futures, if you're speculating on whether the price of soybeans or wheat or bacon will go up or down, at the end of the term, there's soybeans, wheat, or bacon. But with derivatives, you're betting on the prices. You're betting on a bet. And when you start bundling mortgages, this actually started the Bank of America and HSBC and J.P. Morgan were the three firms that actually began this process. They realized that you could take a mortgage and slice it up and package it with 100 other mortgages to the point that no one knows, first of all, who owns the underlying property. Secondly, who knows what the actual valuation is? And then you can start trading them. And then you can buy them and use them for leverage. And where did the leverage come from? Some of it was from the commercial banks, like J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and so on. Some of it came from unregulated offshore hedge funds, the so-called shadow banking system. And before you know it, a house that 5 years earlier was worth $100,000 is now valued at $350,000. There's a mortgage on it that's probably going to cover $500,000 if it's fully paid. It's broken into pieces and stuffed in 25 different derivative packages. And then that mortgage, that $100,000 house, is part of a package which is bringing in $100 billion in leverage. And that's how the bubble was built. And behind all of it was the backing of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which ultimately were the source of liquidity when all else failed. And that's what led to the collapse in 2008. But that derivative contract operation in real estate was only part of it, because they had commodity derivatives. They had foreign exchange derivatives. They set up something called weather derivatives, where a firm that sells winter clothing could buy an insurance policy in case the weather was warm that winter and their sales were low. And who was selling these derivatives? It was the same group. They were creating the bad assets. They were buying and selling them. And then when people got nervous, they created something called credit default swaps, which were insurance, supposedly risk insurance instruments that you could buy so that if your underlying asset value collapsed, you could supposedly cash it in as an insurance. But there was no money to back this up. It was a pure and simple Ponzi scheme, and it was enabled by the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999. It was enabled by the corruption of the rating agencies and the failure of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodities Future Trading Corporation, and all the regulatory agencies to look into what was going on. And in some cases, they were outmatched, and in other cases, they just didn't bother. And that's what happened in 2008. Now, here's the real tragedy. The reason I went through this thing on derivatives is that supposedly we had a change in 2009, 2010 with Dodd-Frank. But that's a 1,500 page bill. The sections on derivatives and swaps were written by the derivative dealers and the swap dealers to give them a way out. And there was only one part of Dodd-Frank that cracked down on derivatives. And that was one that 4 years from now would have ended, or 2 years from now, would have ended the FDIC guarantee of commodity derivatives. And last December, when the oil prices were dropping and $1.6 trillion of derivatives, mostly held by Citibank and Bank of America, and I believe Deutsche Bank, were threatened, Citibank got a bill added to a congressional bill, I think a defense bill, that repealed the part of Dodd-Frank that would have removed FDIC protection. In other words, Citibank got the Congress to restore FDIC protection for these speculative investments. And who supported that? Who pushed it through? Barack Obama, Jamie Dimon, McConnell, and Boehner. The same grouping that's behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's to keep Glass-Steagall out. This is the group we're dealing with, a bunch of criminals. You know, Obama's impeachable, Boehner and McConnell should be kicked out, and Jamie Dimon should be doing a lot of time.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. And I'm going to add a couple of things. You know, MERS, you know, was created by Larry Mizell in 1993, and I've got this thing tied back to the Sharpstown Savings and Loan, which happens to be one of the same ones Pete Bruton picked up on in his book, The Mafia, CIA, and Bush, that I contribute to.
Stu, you'll appreciate this. My office is about a mile from the Sharpstown Center in Houston.
Oh, is it really?
Right down the street from it.
Apparently.
And Sharp was backed by the corrupt John Connally.
Yep, and this goes back as a test run when George Herbert Walker Bush was CIA director. It goes back to this 95 to 97 times frame with Mizell, and of course Mizell and the attorney Norman Brownstein are both APEC directors, Simon Wiesenthal directors, and the whole bit that are controlling this friggin' Congress, the Senate. But, you know, Eric Holder, I want to point out something because people don't know this. Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer are now representing, their law firm represents HSCB Bank.
And here, well, it's Covington and Burling Law Firm, which
yes.
Holder came from,
yes.
And now he's right back with them. And did you hear what he said as his justification? He said, well, I like the fact that we do a lot of pro bono work. I'm sure he's not doing much pro bono work.
No, originally you're supposed to have a $70 million a year payoff to obstruct justice and keep everything covered up with J.P. Morgan. But, you know, what I find interesting, I'm going to tell you something that I learned. Now, and I had a friend of mine in the Pentagon says, Stu, you're going to love this. I said, boy, and this was about a month ago. You remember when Loretta Lynch was finally confirmed?
Maybe. Yeah, right after she covered up HSBC.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Now, Loretta Lynch, he says, you watch and you go back to archives on the date on this radio network. Just, I think it was on a Wednesday it occurred or Tuesday. On a Monday, I came out and said that Larry Mizell was going to get a presidential pardon for $1 billion and that Loretta Lynch's confirmation will go through being held up supposedly because of an anti-abortion bill or something. And those were the Republicans being controlled by, you know, John McCain, and McCain answers to Larry Mizell all the time out of Denver. And I said, you watch. She's going to be confirmed. Eric Holder will resign the next day. And Barack Obama just gave Larry Mizell a presidential pardon for something he hadn't even been tried for or convicted or indicted. You can't give a presidential pardon unless the person's been indicted over this mortgage fraud and derivative fraud.
So he got a get-out-of-jail-free card?
Yes, he got a jail-free card. The next day, two days after I made this announcement it was going to happen, Loretta Lynch got confirmed. Eric Holder resigned the following day, made the announcement he's resigning the following day, made his big speech. And the night that he gave the pardon, the next morning, when Loretta Lynch was confirmed and said, oh, she's going to be sworn in and everything, Barack Obama, I heard it on CNN, which I just turned on to see what the propaganda is for the day, that Barack Obama held a private fundraiser for his library the night before and raised $100 million for his library.
Well, we're talking about people who have had their way. And, you know, when you talk about this question of Loretta Lynch, just to give a little more background on her, she worked for a period of time. She was a board member of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the center of the corruption in the Federal Reserve system, because they're basically the ones, the duty of the New York Fed is to make sure there's liquidity for the New York money center banks.